everybody that you run into. How in the world do you think anybody's supposed to respect you? It's a brand new day. Respect yourself. Well, this is Mental Health Radio, taken from us. Beautiful day in the city of Sales today. Lovely to see the sun and a little bit more warmth. Taken from us is brought to you and funded by Ember Wellbeing Trust. And I'm host Sheldon Brown with technician Declan Curran. And today we're going to address a fairly controversial issue, and it's about the discrepancy in spending between suicide and road safety. You know, despite deaths each year from suicide being almost twice the current road toll, spending on suicide prevention lags about $1 billion behind spending on road safety and reducing the road toll. Deaths on the road total about 380 last year. Deaths from suicide are almost double that at almost 670, and that's according to the provisional coronial figures. So how does this add up? Late last year, the government announced a $1.4 billion three-year program to make New Zealand's riskiest roads safer. This program is called the Safe Network Program. It will make 870 kilometres of high-volume, high-risk state highway safer by within a couple of years, with improvements like median and side barriers, rumble strips and shoulder widening. The program will target an estimated $600 to $700 million of state highway safety improvements and $700 to $800 million of local road safety improvements. Once complete, the improvements are expected to prevent 160 deaths and serious injuries. So that's an improvement in the road toll of 160 at a spending of about $1.4 billion. In the government's announcement resulting from its inquiry into mental health and addictions, it was announced that $40 million will be spent on suicide prevention. To me, it's ironic that there are campaigns for both zero road deaths and zero suicide. I mean, they are very catchy sort of phrases, very attractive sort of goals, but I'd say very unrealistic, as it seems to me, given that road and suicide deaths are currently mounting. The Minister of Transport, Phil Twyford, said the Safe Network program will build urgent safety improvements on our roads at scale and pace over the next 3 years to save lives. Drivers will inevitably make mistakes, and it's the government's job to stop those mistakes turning into tragedies. I mean, that's a fascinating statement in itself, and I can't imagine Mr. Twyford making that sort of statement about suicide. Julianne Genta, who is the Associate Minister of Transport, she says our government believes it is unacceptable for anyone to be killed or seriously injured on our roads. Annual road deaths in New Zealand increased from 253 just a few years ago to 378 last year. The number of serious injuries increased from over 2,000 to 2,836 a year. It says no other industry accepts hundreds of people dying each year as normal. No person I know thinks losing a loved one in a crash is an acceptable price to pay for living in a modern society. That's why we're making safety a priority. I haven't heard anybody make the same statement about mental health and the suicide rate. No one has said no other industry accepts hundreds of people dying each year as normal. I certainly don't say that in mental health circles. Losing loved ones to suicide is just as, if not more, tragic. Yet the reality is that these deaths are often hidden, locked away in the closet, not talked about, and certainly don't gain the news coverage of multi-death car crashes, which undoubtedly are an embarrassment to our government and the authorities which manage road safety. In addition to the government's $1.4 billion spend on road campaigns and safety, I read a news report that Auckland Transport here in the City of Sails is separately planning to spend $700 million on making Auckland's roads more safe, because the city's road toll is much higher than it should be. The government's road safety program will also deliver a nationwide advertising campaign to help raise awareness and conversation about why we must change some of our riskiest roads to prevent more road trauma. In mental health, the closest we've got to a campaign on suicide prevention was the tentative Like Mine promotions on television, which to my knowledge have disappeared off the screens and were very subtle in terms of addressing suicide and preventing suicide. What frustrates me is the continuing misinformation put out by the Ministry of Health, stating that our suicide rate is around 500 a year. If you look up on the Ministry of Health's latest website, or latest information on its website, it says every year over 500 people die by suicide in New Zealand. Well, that statement is an underestimation by about 20%, because the provisional figures are that there are 668 people dying from suicide. This same perception is given in the Director of Mental Health and Addictions annual report. Dr. John Crawshaw also uses this figure of about 500 people dying by suicide. And to me, this seems to be a deliberate attempt to underplay the significance and the figures. The ministry says, has a devastating impact on the lives of the people involved and impacts all of us in some way. The New Zealand Suicide Prevention Strategy 2006 to 2016, which has guided suicide prevention activity in New Zealand, has come to an end. How many, even those working in mental health, know we have no suicide prevention strategy currently? That's 3 years since the last strategy expired. And a spokesman for the minister, who I approached deliberately for this program, told me it will hopefully be released by the end of this year. Well, let's bring in our guest here, Corinda Taylor from Dunedin. We've spoken to Corinda before. She is the chair of the Life Matters Suicide Prevention Trust in Dunedin. Corinda, you're there on the phone?
I am.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Sheldon.
And you were able to hear those views of mine as a result of a bit of research on the internet.
Yes, absolutely. And you raised some really important points there.
Thank you. So what is your stance on this spending discrepancy between road safety and suicide prevention?
Yeah, well, there's an obvious big difference in the amount of money that's being spent on our road toll versus suicide prevention. And I guess, you know, if you look at how successful the road toll has been addressed and how it was brought down, you can only but wonder what a big difference that would make if we applied the same efforts and funding to suicide prevention.
So the same sort of tactics, the same sort of promotion. They're talking about a nationwide advertising campaign.
Absolutely.
Have you ever, in your experience in suicide prevention, seen a national advertising campaign to try and reduce suicide and prevent it?
I don't actually watch TV, but no, I haven't. But you know, if you look at, I've asked some young people this morning about their views on this particular topic. And I was told from a very young age, they've been educated about our road toll. They know not to drink and drive. They are very well aware of that. But that education part has worked really well. Now, imagine they applied mental health. They started that sort of education in primary schools and educated our young people, a little bit like what they talk about. One person told about me about Harold the Giraffe, which is a primary school bus that goes around, the Life Education Trust, and they talk about general health. Now imagine they use that for mental health and make it okay for our young people to talk about their mental health and then to reach out. So that is one thing that can be done. The other problem is then when they do reach out for help, that is a huge problem.
So you're saying if they do need to reach out for help, they perhaps their mental health is deteriorating, their mood perhaps is low, and you're suggesting, well, where do they find that help?
Yeah, because it's non-existent, basically. That is a big problem for many people.
So, I wonder what sort of form a nationwide advertising campaign would take if it was related to suicide prevention. You've mentioned the drink driving and how they've addressed the dangers of driving drunk or driving drugged. But, living our lives drinking too much or using drugs is likely to jeopardise our mental health, isn't it? And therefore, we could be at risk of doing something dangerous, unsafe. Would you see that sort of those sorts of issues as being important in terms of?
Yeah, absolutely. We all know alcohol is a depressant and it takes away your inhibition, so you end up in situations you wouldn't have been in if you were sober. But, it takes me back to you mentioned earlier about nationwide campaigns. So we did have John Kirwan. I don't know if you remember, he advertised on TV and it was a big campaign talking about mental health. And I think that was the first time people actually said, okay, let's reach out for help. And so there was this imbalance. So suddenly people started to reach out for help and they found that services were just not there to help them.
So he was clearly promoting depression.org.nz. He was clearly promoting the value of exercise, of eating well, of and calling for help. But are you saying that campaign generated so much demand that it couldn't be fulfilled?
That's right. Yeah, and we often hear, if we take, our biggest population, the biggest cohort of people that have got the highest risk, at the highest risk of suicide, is that 18 to 24-year-olds. Now, if one of those people reach out for help, I consistently hear the same story, that they either don't fit the criteria for mental health, or there's a massive big waiting list. They should go private. And if we talk about students or people on being unemployed, so they can't afford to go private. They can hardly afford to go to their GP. So we have a population of people that just cannot access services early enough. So then we wait till they are in crisis. Once people are in crisis, it's almost, I won't say it's too late, but it's harder to fix.
Well, even in crisis, you have, it seems, you have certain criteria that you've got to meet in order to be able to get to see somebody, to get to see a professional. And we interviewed somebody not so long ago who came back from a suicide attempt in from Australia, from Sydney, and she was told she would have to wait 10 weeks and fortunately her parents had sufficient funds to access a psychologist or a counsellor, and then it was discovered that ACC was going to pick up the bill because of her history. So there was no money that needed to change hands. But I imagine a lot of the 18 and to 24 year olds don't consult with their parents. They're perhaps too embarrassed to do that. They don't want to declare a weakness, and so they try and address this themselves. Would that be a fair assumption?
Yes, that's a very fair assumption. And so people end up supporting one another, and they do it very well. But, you know, I think, you know, if you then do go to your GP, the GP is most likely to go, here's some antidepressants, go and take it and I hope you get better. I think it is very short-sighted to just prescribe medication. I think if you prescribe medication, you should prescribe therapy or counselling at the same time, so that they can be taken in combination, because sometimes medication takes a while to work, and you sometimes need somebody you can talk to about your feelings. And that's really where the problem is. You can't get that counselling.
So some DHBs do offer, I think, 6 sessions of counselling, which GPs can access if they are part of a PHO, a primary health organisation. Is that the case in Dunedin?
Yes, it is. However, there's always a however for me. Some people need more than the 6 sessions. There's also a long, long waiting list often, and they will throw you out after 6 sessions.
Right. So there's no there's no sort of you there's no freedom for the service to say, well, clearly you need further therapy. We can extend this by a couple of sessions or 4 sessions.
No, they cut that umbilical cord and they say that's it. It's over now.
Right.
And so where do you go from there? Now, just to give you an example, so my husband has been engaged since we lost our son to suicide. We both needed ongoing counselling because we're grieving and, you know, losing somebody to suicide in your family immediately puts you at risk yourself. And he's just been told. So this is what's kept him alive, the counselling, okay? But he's just been told he can no longer use the service.
So
because he doesn't have a mental illness.
But he's grieving the loss of his son.
Yeah, and the counselling is what keeps him alive. So they are turning him away and they go, sorry, we can no longer help you because you do not fit the criteria. Now, he will have to start all over. We can't afford it. We've had many years of expense you know, legal fees and what have you. Why should we pay? We've paid our taxes over the years.
So we have obviously this inquiry, the outcomes of the inquiry, a promise by the government that mental health will benefit to the tune of about $1.4 billion overall for all of these services. I think one of the things they are promising is to put a mental health specialist into GP clinics. At some stage, all of this is likely to happen probably later rather than sooner, because the findings and the outcomes have only really just been announced. Do you think that this is going to make a difference?
Oh, I think that's a good thing. I just want to correct you. You said $1.4 billion. It was actually $40
million. For suicide, yes. For suicide prevention. But overall, yes. As a result of the inquiry into mental health and addictions, they're going to spend $1.4 billion over the next 3 years on mental health improvements.
Yeah. I think that's a good start. But that's not going to fix the problem. And I think you also raised it previously, that the suicide prevention strategy that has expired, you know, in 2016. I mean, that is a real shame. That's a shame on our country that strategy plan has not been updated. And, you know, they've left out the most important voices from helping to develop that strategy. I've actually seen that plan. I've seen some holes in it, which we probably won't have time to discuss today. So there's a lot of work to be done behind the scenes. And, you know, I fear that families shouldn't be forced to mount press campaigns to ensure that change happens. And this is what we've done, you know.
You've tried to influence what is going to be included in the new suicide prevention strategy. And one of the controversial issues is that the government has refused to put a figure on how much they want suicide reduced. I think somebody suggested it should be 20% a year, but clearly they've fallen away from any sort of target. Why do you think that is, Corinda?
Well, they don't want to be held accountable if they can't deliver on their target. But we all know about targets and how effective that is for the smoking campaign, the smoking targets. You know, you break an arm, you go to the hospital, the first thing they ask you if you are a smoker. If you are a smoker, they offer you support how to get off your smoke. Now, if you were to go to the hospital with self-harm, they're unlikely to ask you if you are suicidal.
Right.
But they will offer you support with your smoking. So, you know, I just think... you know, target is a good thing. However, by taking the target away, they have gone to say no death by suicide is acceptable, yet there is no target. So they're not going to be able, we won't be able to hold them accountable because they didn't deliver.
Right. I guess there is a link between the road toll and suicide, and this is really a question that I have in my own mind, that I wonder how many fatal accidents are suicides. I mean, have you heard that being raised in
yeah. So that is one of the problems that you also raised earlier on. The Ministry of Health goes, we've got about 500 suicides a year, and the chief coroner reports every year on the suspected suicides. And the reason why there's such a big difference in that figure. It's kind of hard to explain, but for argument's sake, it takes more than a year to complete an inquiry into a suspected suicide. Definitely in our case, it's more than 6 years. The majority of people I speak to, it's been more than two, sometimes 3 or 4 years before they have any questions answered. And of those 668 suicides, some of them will not be suicides.
Only a small proportion, though, I think, Corinda. You know, it's not going to impact that total of 668 by a significant margin.
I agree. And there will be other accidents, road car accidents, that will not be in the 668 either, because how can you prove it? It was a car accident.
Right, but Declan, our technician here, was sharing with me a story where somebody had some health issues. He'd had an argument with his loved ones, and his car veers across the road into a truck. He is killed. There's carnage everywhere. Well, was that a suicide?
And I guess that the coroner will always look at the fact, if there was a note that said that the person was going to do that, most likely it will be a suicide then. But if there was no note, and possibly the family didn't want it to be called a suicide, it possibly won't be a suicide then.
Right. One of the things I read about in terms of the road toll is that, in fact, the government calculates what the social cost of road crashes and injuries is. And in 2017, it says that the total social cost of motor vehicle injury crashes is $4.8 billion, up by 15%. From the 2016 figure. I mean, have you ever seen any estimate of the social cost of suicide?
I have. And off the top of my head, I cannot remember the figure, but it's massive for just one person that died by suicide. The social cost is massive. We're talking, we're talking thousands of dollars, possibly over $100,000.
Per suicide.
Per person. Yeah.
But does that also take into account the perhaps, like you were referring to with your husband, that the therapy, the cost of therapy, the loss of employment, the loss of income as a result, the grief, the time it takes. I mean, are those factors calculated into that social cost of suicide?
I don't know how they calculate that cost. I really don't know, but possibly they look at the potential that person would have had a job, the income that person would have generated. I can only guess how they get to that figure. I've got no idea.
Right. Well, Corinda, I wonder if we could take a music break, and please stay on the line. Are you okay there?
Yes, sure.
Thank you.
Well, I was just going to throw in there something very quickly, and that was do you need to have a mental health diagnosis to get the service? Because obviously if somebody's taken their life, then you as a survivor need that assistance for your own, well-being. So how do you define that? Mm-hmm. Anyway, I have a track here for you, which is by Rupert Holmes, actually. It's based upon a what-if scenario. The music is a repetitive, steady vamp, so the lyrics had to be the focal point. The guy, as I say, Rupert Holmes, that did it, saw a glowing advertisement in the personal columns, and it got him thinking, what would happen if you were to sort of get a bit bored with your relationship and want to find somebody else? The song, of course, is the Pina Colada song, it's known as Escape. It's Rupert Holmes. You're listening to Take It From Us, Mental Health Radio, broadcasting every Tuesday here from 12:30 to 1:30 on 104.6 Planet FM.
A worn-out recording of a favorite song. So while she lay there sleeping, I read the paper in bed. And in the personal columns, there was this letter I read. If you like piña coladas and getting caught in the rain, if you're not my lady, I know that sounds kind of mean, but me and my old lady have fallen into the same old routine. So I wrote to the paper, took out a personal ad, and though I'm nobody's poet, I thought it wasn't half bad.
We're just going to tone that down since we have Corinda Taylor, the chair of Life Matters Suicide Prevention Trust in Dunedin, on the phone. Corinda, you're still there?
Yes, I am.
That song, Escape, I guess that's pretty significant in terms of suicide. I mean, suicide in many cases would be, I guess, about escaping from the traumas of life.
Yeah, and most people just want to escape from the pain, and they if we can offer them alternatives, you know, we can save lives.
So your work as the chair of Life Matters, my understanding is that you have little, if any, government funding, so you have to rely on funding Life Matters on your own initiative.
Yes, so we are very lucky to have a supportive community, and actually we've received funding nationwide now from lots of different people. But yes, no government funding and no support for the work that we do from the government, or no even acknowledgement for the work that we do. In the break, I just looked up again to bring back about the economic cost. So I just Googled about the Office of the Auditor General, who estimates that in each death, the combined loss of an individual's contribution to society, the economy, and an individual's family amounted to 3.4 million.
What, per individual?
Yep. And it says the economic cost alone was put at 600,000. So that's massive. So surely it's cheaper to keep somebody alive.
Well, it's much more productive to keep people alive, and all that grief and loss and devastation, of course, wouldn't happen, would it?
Yeah. So imagine you spend that amount of money on just a few people. I mean, just imagine what a difference we could make to our suicide rate.
So when you say if we could spend that money just even on a few people, if you had that money, what would you see as the priorities?
Yes, good question. So I see a lot of people that are turned away from crisis care. I see a lot of people turning away when they realize they need early intervention, you know, before they get to crisis point. So money needs to be spent on counseling very early on, so that when people reach out that they can get an appointment at least within, you know, a couple of days, if not a couple of weeks. They should not have to wait months. And then for me, the issue is when people go to the emergency services, they sit in a very unfriendly environment with nobody to support them often. They get seen by a clinician and assessed. By that time, the person just wants to go home because they're fed up of waiting, but they're still suicidal. They are then turned away from the crisis intervention that they reached out to, often citing lack of beds, or they treated in a very unfriendly way often.
What about the option of respite?
So I'm getting to that. So that nobody should be alone in a clinical situation, that there are advocates and peer support workers everywhere to support that suicidal person that is reaching out to the service, especially in the emergency setting. If there is no bed available, there needs to be, like you said, respite, but sort of more like a homely place where people can go and they have people to look after them, that they're not turfed out onto the street like my son was in the middle of the night.
From an acute psychiatric unit or from a respite home?
No, emergency services.
Can I just jump in there quickly and say that when I had my first suicidal attempt and I was taken by ambulance into hospital, they had me there for a few hours, and then at sometime between 2 and 3 in the morning they said, you can go now. And I said, well, how am I going to get home? They said, oh, well, you'll find a way. So I basically walked from North Shore Hospital all the way home. It took me about an hour or more. It was on Christmas Eve, actually. And that makes me wonder. And I just think, too, if you're in a clinical environment and you've got the people that are there that aren't giving you what you need, how does that affect and impact on your self-esteem when you're already feeling low with what you're going through anyway?
Yeah, that's massive. Well, you know, that should never happen. And, I mean, I can only imagine how that made you feel on Christmas Eve of all times.
Well, one of the positive things about it was going home was very magical because I got to see all the lights on and the Christmas trees and walk past a friend's house on the way home, and he said afterwards, oh, you should have stopped in and woken me up. I said, at 3 a.m? So, you know, I went from there, and the impact on that, you know, where you have the whole self-esteem thing, I actually said to the mental health people, I don't want my family contacting me for a week. I'll send them a letter, but I just need that space to stand back. And so it's not the impact it has on you, but what about your loved ones who are essentially outside the fence looking in thinking, what the hell do we do?
I was just going to ask Declan, Corinda, you were going home to an empty home.
Yeah, coming back home to my own home. And when I got home, there was a message on the messaging machine, which Dad said afterwards, when he'd gone up to the house after I'd gone, he would have deleted if he could. And basically it was saying, what the hell's wrong with you? You've got a nice home, you've got a nice car, you've got a job, get your bloomin' shite together and get on with it and that sort of thing. So when I walked in and heard that, straight away I just thought, well, I felt like the black sheep of the family, basically. You know, and that's one of the reasons why I took that week back, where I just thought I can't face family because I've already gone through what I've gone through, and now I feel like I'm being criticised and stared down at by my family, which wasn't the case. But
But this is the other thing. You know, nobody should be left alone when, especially when they've presented to services asking for help or after a suicide attempt. To let somebody go alone and unsupported in the middle of the night is just, it's reckless.
Well, particularly when you get police and ambulance and you can hear them basically gunning from the street across the road up to your front door and take you away by ambulance. There you go. You can go now. It's 3 a.m. Just walk home. Yeah. You know, who's to say I wasn't going to walk in? I could have walked out in front of anything, you know, or anything could have happened.
So, Corinda, in some ways we're talking about so much of what has been revealed by this inquiry into mental health and addictions, that there is a crisis, that the system is broken, the government has responded. It's probably too early to tell whether their new budget of $1.4 billion over 3 years is going to make a difference. Some of it is already, I think, being spent, and there are new initiatives rolling out. But, I mean, have you seen at the coalface, as chair of Life Matters Suicide Prevention Trust in Dunedin, have you seen any change?
No, I haven't. You know, I find it quite disturbing to realise that people go to the services, say, for argument's sake, emergency services. It still happens as we speak here, and being told to leave, and then they go, well, I can't leave because I'm still unwell, and being asked to leave again, and then being told, if you don't leave now, we will call security and have you trespassed.
So these are people presenting with mental health crises, perhaps suicidal, they may have self-harmed, those sorts of people?
Yeah. So the service will go, well, we don't think you are suicidal, you know, you need to go now. But, you know, obviously the person doesn't feel safe. But, you know, more than that, they don't even facilitate ongoing support. You know, when that person walks out that door, they don't, like Declan said, they don't know where that person is going next. Well, we sometimes get the people coming to us at the Hope Centre because often people just want somebody to listen to them. It's
so
not rocket science.
Your reference to a Hope Centre, you run a Hope Centre at Life Matters Suicide Prevention Trust.
Yeah.
So you're getting the sort of discards, if you like.
Well, yes, the rejects. They reject them. They just, you know, it's not fair.
Yeah, that's
just not fair.
That just reminded me, it's like putting somebody on a diet, getting them to a really fit place and then just throwing junk food at them. And the problem I have with this is, it's all very well for them to say, and okay, I don't know the background behind what they're doing with the restructuring, but it's all very well to say we're going to put so much money into it, but how many more people have to go through trauma and lose their lives before the actual money turns into a reality? And that's the concern that I have, is that you're bringing these people into this emergency system, they're trying to treat them, and then when they get them to a point where they might have some form of hope, they're like, there's the door, buzz off. And you've just undone all that work.
Well, I think, you know? Corinda, you're saying that they don't get very much treatment. They go to the emergency department as a last-ditch effort to get help, and they're deemed to be not seriously mentally unwell to be treated there, and so they're rejected.
But here's one of the problems, is if you present yourself to a hospital and you've got blood everywhere or a broken bone, they can see what it is, they can attend to you and give you that care, they'll put you in nice meals, whatever. When you're going with mental illness, it's what's going on inside, and essentially your brain, to me, is like the motor of your car. If that ain't working well, the car's not going to go very far, and to me, I think, you know, there need to be serious changes. And now, maybe they need to look at overhauling the whole thing and saying, hey, we've got the highest suicide rate in all of the OCD, you know, countries and that. We've got the worst suicide rate. Why can't we have first-class mental health treatment that actually says you're worth putting this effort into and we're going to get you back to a place and walk with you on this journey?
Well, just to reinforce what Declan is saying, I mean, the media headlines were saying the number of people who have taken their own lives in New Zealand is the highest since records began, with 668 dying by suicide in the past year. It was the fourth year in a row that that number has increased. It was also the highest number of suspected suicide deaths since the coroner's annual provisional suicide statistics were first recorded in 2007-08.
Can I just throw something quickly in there? And I was just going to say that, you know, that's what, those are the deaths that we're dealing with. How many people are out there that are actually having serious suicidal thoughts and getting right to the edge and maybe managing to just step back from actually going too far?
Or they may make an attempt, quite a serious attempt, and live through it. So, I mean, that you mentioned the Hope Centre, Corinda. This is one of your services in Dunedin.
Yes, So we get we've trained a group of people to be peer support volunteers in the Hope Centre. So. Some days we have people drop in here. Mostly I prefer to have it by appointment, mainly because we've got funding issues and, you know, staffing issues. You know, we're just a young organization. But ultimately, I would like to see this turn into a crisis cafe where we could have a 24/7 staff present here so that people who are turned away from emergency services can come here for a cup of tea, cup of coffee, hot chocolate, bite to eat, sit on the couch, have a sleep on the couch if you have to, and have people to listen to you because, as I said, people just want somebody to validate their feelings and to hear what they have to say.
So there would be a peer support volunteers or professional peer support people available for these people to talk to. The if I can make a comment, that sounds a bit like the old drop-in centre. And, of course, drop-in centres have, many years ago, I think, lost their, the funders don't like them. So they've dropped out. Drop-in centres have gone. But, you know, it does strike me that if you are in a crisis like this, you may be rejected by mental health services or emergency departments. There aren't any other places to go. There aren't those sorts of drop-ins, are there?
That's right, because people get sick after hours.
Right.
And that's a good.
Nobody gets sick between 9 to 5.
That's a good preventative thing, I was going to say, too, with people being able to drop in. You've got support of other people that are perhaps going through something similar.
Yeah. That's right.
And that's going to take the burden. That's going to take away the burden from those emergency departments because it will hopefully help prevent people from getting to that stage and getting into a very clinical environment.
Because the clinical model hasn't worked, we know that very well.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And that's failed me on two occasions, to be honest with you.
So if people were attracted to Life Matters, and they are attracted to Life Matters, are you able to refer them, perhaps, to services that they may not be aware of?
Absolutely. So part of what we do here is we help people navigate the complications of the mental health services. So, and therein lies the other problem. You know, we are able to engage with somebody at very short notice and connect them with good support. Many people don't know about the 6 brief intervention sessions they can get through the GP. We had somebody that couldn't access services recently a young person who falls in that category of the 18 to 24 year olds. They couldn't connect with the service. We tried another service. And eventually, because we also subsidized a therapist, so eventually the person could see our own therapist. But that shouldn't happen. The government should pick that up. Our community shouldn't have to sponsor therapy for people. The government, they've got the money. They should do it.
So, you know, I'm just mindful that we do have a new environment in mental health. There has been this huge inquiry. Have you seen any opportunities where Life Matters Suicide Prevention Trust is going to be able to gain some government recognition and some government funding out of this pot?
No, I don't see that happening at all. I mean, we were instrumental to get this mental health inquiry to happen. I have not seen any recognition for that from our current government or even the previous government. But it's not about recognition. I don't even think the money will filter through to us. I think the money, my guess is, the money will go to the DHBs again, who will have total control. And doing the same thing over and over again is not going to give you a different result.
Right.
We know that. Mm. So they basically will have to start from scratch. We know our clinical psychologists are going on strike. They don't employ enough of those.
So they're striking. What's the reason for their strike in the South?
Well, they have to, I think, from memory, they have to work a lot of overtime. They just don't employ enough psychologists. Whether there's a shortage of psychologists, I'm not too sure, or whether they just do not employ them. Possibly the psychologists leave because of the workload and they burn out at the DHBs. But I know of people that are engaging with, you know, that using a mental health team, a community team, and they can't get counselling sessions.
Mm. How would you describe the work that you're doing? I mean, how would you describe that?
Well, first of all, we are advocates, so we are on the person's side. We do a lot of complaints for people, so people come here and they go, well, this happened, and so we help them navigate until they get good support.
And those complaints would be what, to the Human Rights Commission? Or
Health and Disability Commissioner, sometimes, you know, Privacy Commissioner or the Ombudsman. So we just help people to navigate complaints. And also then the coroner's inquest. So that is a big thing. So people cannot afford legal counsel, you know, unless you're wealthy, you cannot afford it. Right. And that again comes into that economic cost to families, to an individual's family. It's massive. I mean, we've put thousands and thousands of dollars into legal support for ourselves to ensure that we have the right outcome. This should never happen. If this was a homicide, we would have free legal support. And we would have access to, I think, 30 free counselling sessions.
Right.
In comparison to what? For suicide relief? Nothing?
That's a subject that I would like to address with you in a different broadcast, because obviously there is a move to try and get greater justice for the survivors of suicide. And I think there is a major campaign being addressed right at the moment to the Minister of Justice. So I'd like to address that. It's very wonderful that you have made yourself available on this subject, and thank you for your preparation and your thoughts. We've just got a couple of community notices we need to cover off. So thank you, Corinda, again, from Take It From Us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Good on you. Thank you.
Well, have we got we've got time for a music track.
Okay.
I've got one here for the young ones. It's called Taste the Feeling by Avicii and Conrad Sewell, and it's a Coca-Cola released promotional song from 2016 for their Taste the Feeling campaign. And Sewell's actually an Aussie, which I didn't know. So here's the song, Taste the Feeling.
It feels good in my heart, in my soul, when you're right here beside me. I don't ever want this day to end. Watch the waves, have a coke, and just sit here beside me. I take a little of my heart again, so we can feel forever. You feel together, be real together, and no one can stop me when I taste that feeling. Nothing could ever. Make it easier to sing, yeah. Make it easier to sing, yeah. It feels good as we stand on the shore and now hearts are jumping. I grab another coke and let's dive in. We see the stars align. We make the simple moments last for a lifetime. So we'll feel forever, you and me together. Make us feel forever and be real together. No.
Well, I'm host Sheldon Brown of Take It From Us with Declan here as the technician. Congratulations to AOK.New Zealand, who we interviewed. We interviewed Caroline, the managing director, about 3 or 4 weeks ago. They have been nominated for a Westpac Auckland Business Award. They're in the running for the People's Choice Award at the 2019 Westpac Auckland Business Award. So congratulations to AOK, which is a suicide prevention organisation and runs workshops just like Life Matters does. Also, Changing Minds seems to be in some sort of relationship with Grow. They have a seminar coming up in Wellington called Activating Hope on the 29th and 30th of July, and Growing Through in August Well, the 1st of August in Dunedin, 2nd of August in Auckland. So check out the Grow website or Changing Minds for those. So we're out of here.
Yeah, we'll see you next week, guys. Look after yourself.